BBC Radio 4 News.
Now, Thinking Aloud with Laurie Taylor.
Hello. You know, I can't believe it's 8 years since I interviewed Richard Sennett on this programme about his book, The Corrosion of Character. But I can readily recollect the amount of correspondence that interview prompted. Scores of people not only wanted to commend his brilliant analysis of the nature of contemporary work and the effects this had upon the character of employees, but also wanted to provide their own examples of short-term contract, downsizing, the privileging of youth over experience, the death of lifelong careers, unemployment, and the new management emphasis upon teamwork and self-motivation. So you'll understand how excited I was to learn of the publication of a book based on a series of lectures Richard recently gave at Yale University, which brings these themes up to date and also considers the manner in which the new economy might be breeding a new politics. The book's called The Culture of the New Capitalism. It's already been lauded in the States as brilliant, disturbing, and absolutely necessary reading, and as vintage Sennett, moving with grace between big ideas and specific cases. When I talked this morning to Richard Sennett, who's currently Professor of Social Sciences at MIT and Professor of Sociology at LSE, no lack of work there then, I began by going back to the starting point for his analysis. The nature of changes over time in large corporations and industrial enterprises.
Towards the end of the 19th century, after a period in which capitalism was really cowboy activity, people didn't know how stock markets worked, they didn't really know how to organize big factories, surprisingly, in an efficient way. A period of consolidation sets in, and what happens is basically that models from military life are imposed on civic life. This is what Max Weber called about the deep relation between militarism and capitalism. The chain of command is now articulated in running businesses. People have stable jobs that if they don't do, somebody else can do, but the job is stable. It's a kind of hierarchical pyramid in which this big beast of organizational life finally really becomes well organized. When I started researching this work a decade ago about how capitalism might be changing, I was looking not at a kind of huge transformation at the center of work, but something on the kind of cutting edge of it, and specialized kinds of businesses, which seemed to have consequences for this classic way of running a hierarchic organization. I looked at people working in high-tech firms, people working in the media, in advertising industries, in business sectors. And there you saw a different kind of organization of work taking form. It was one where the fixity of position no longer existed. Indeed, the fixity of companies no longer existed. Company could sell X widget one year, and the next year it was selling Y widget, or it's selling no widgets at all.
I just remember that lovely thing on fixity of position. I think it was Peter's, the management guru in one of his books said, that what you must do is throw away your business cards, because your business cards will state what your position is. You must never know what your position is. You can't say assistant general manager.
Right.
That means that you belong really to an inefficient organization.
Well, another instance of that was Welsh, who was the head of GE, who always kept an office empty with the door open next to his own. And he would point to people as going by, and he said, nobody has a right to that space. You could be cleaned out tomorrow. Yeah. It's that kind of world. And what that did in this kind of cutting-edge, very globalized realm was take apart for the people who worked in it, top to bottom, the sense that they had something like a career. Their sense of time became radically compressed. They had jobs. And whether they left organizations or whether they moved around in them, the experience of work changed from something that had a narrative to something that was a short-term transaction.
Before we turn to some of those discontents, there is a nice irony that you point out, because you quote from the 60s, I think it's the Fort Huron statement assembled by various people on the left then, which talked about the necessity of getting rid of large institutions and bureaucracies, because once you removed these, then the possibility arose of genuine human community.
Yes.
Now, but you might say that some of the new organizations that you are describing, you know, perhaps the Silicon Valley organizations, must have been influenced by that notion of breaking down bureaucracy and normal institutional control.
Yes. We suffered, we aging new leftists, seeing our wish come half true. You have to remember that in the 60s, people on the new left had identified bureaucracy per se as kind of the enemy of freedom. And whether it was in the Soviet Union or whether it was in Britain, that this was the institutional kind of spine of totalitarian rule. So to us, the notion of making organizations more flexible would make them free. And indeed, you know, the irony of this is that when this new form of working first came into being, a lot of these business gurus spoke the language of the new left. You know, this is freedom, yeah. You know, more democratic and so on. Today they're not so shameless, but because we've seen the consequences.
Gates was a bit of a hippie hero.
He was. And in the three books that I've done on this subject, they're the kind of unfurling story of why this taking apart of bureaucracy turned out not to be liberating.
Let's talk about some of the ways in which it wasn't liberating. First of all, of course, you move away from the idea of a career, don't you? I mean, what does that, in terms of the psychological, the personal implications of that, I mean, what does that do to one as a person not to have that step-by-step possibility lying ahead of you?
Well, it means that you become very focused on the present and your sense of what something is worth doing to you personally, its kind of strategic importance, is eroded because you can't see what its likely consequences will be. And we've just done a study of young people, quite privileged young people, going into this world compared to young people 30 years ago of a similar background going into it. The kids today are just confused. It's a very illegible world to read. You don't know whether the skills you've gotten are going to be any good in 5 years and so on. So part of this is a personally a problem of being really able to think through what something is worth in terms of thinking through where it's going to carry you in your life. Another side of this is that in this short-term world, the whole experience of fraternity and collegiality weakens. People are in teams in a very short period of time with each other. Most teams kept together in these businesses 6 or 7 months. The managers are afraid people are going to get ingrown by becoming too attached to each other. And so what you get in the workplace in this kind of revolving door is a set of personal relationships that are more superficial than people would like. It takes time in highly pressured work to know who's going to go to pieces, who you can count on. And most of this work is pretty high pressure. If in 7 months you're not going to see that person again, you're not going to know enough about them to really understand what that's about. So there is a price in collegiality, if you like, or fraternity. There's a third price about this, which has to do with the organizations themselves. The same short-term character that marks jobs also marks institutional identity. And that means that people are not sure what their employers want or even who their employers are. I'll give you an example of this. In several of the corporations we studied, it became more common for the managers to move more frequently within the organization or into other firms than the people lower down in the organization. That means if you're not knocking yourself out on a project, or even if you're just doing a good job and you're working steadily hard term, you lose your witness.
Yes.
because the guy above you is off to something else.
And, of course, here we're talking as well a lot about commitment to a particular task, to a particular skill. Now, when we were talking about managers of biscuit factories who then turn up next week as vice-chancellors of universities or, I don't know, head of the BBC. We haven't had a biscuit manufacturer yet, but it can't be far away.
I long for a vice-chancellor of university to turn up as a biscuit maker, but this is that's another story.
But it does mean that those who are working in these places, they don't, I mean, that what they're working on in a year's time, they don't necessarily know it. They've got to have an extraordinary tolerance of ambiguity, whereas before they had a task, this is what they had to do, this had to be finished, this had to be completed, you knew when it was completed, you knew the end, you could see the product. But now?
Well, the reason why I think this generally matters, I mean, you may or may not want to shed crocodile tears for, you know, a young stockbroker who's confused but rich, but the reason this generally matters is that this change at the cutting edge of capitalism has been adopted by governments as a model for the way they ought to provide government services. So you have in Britain this kind of endless churning out of policy, as you know, in the National Health Service of Education, where the model is this quite specialized form of organization, which is new, you know, which is dynamic. Yeah. You say, well, we should make government work like that. And you apply to activities to which they're not suited this kind of notion that the health service is like an IT startup company. And this goes under the name of reform rather than a very problematic kind of experiment. In the second book I wrote about, this book on respect and age of inequality, what this kind of model of the new, of reform, means when it's applied to the welfare state and how it transforms fundamental things that welfare states have to do, like provide security. How can you provide security from organizations which themselves are purposely unstable? Now, maybe you could, but we found that because this conundrum wasn't being faced, because this was, you know, reform is one of those words that makes it feel that anybody resists you must be some kind of old fuddy-duddy, you know, that the institutions became very dysfunctional. People in the National Health Service here speak about change fatigue.
Yes.
Year after year.
And they're teaching as well.
They're teaching the same thing. Police also. The problem in the States and to some extent in Germany, but certainly in Britain, is that because of this modeling of reform politics on the new economy, that very few changes bed in. And the politicians get driven to produce something new every year without what they've done before actually being something that's absorbed into people's experience.
I just want to
very dysfunctional.
Can I just nudge in one other before we move to politicians and before we talk about the way in which the new economy is perhaps breeding a new politics, which is the question that you addressed. Yeah. But I just want to talk about youth and age because the ways in which the new economy has an inbuilt age bias and why that age bias is there.
Well, it's there for several reasons. One of them is not so evident to us. We know that we're living in a world where people have constantly to learn new skills or refresh the skills they have. Here's the problem. It's cheaper for an employer to hire fresh minted somebody who has that skill than to retrain somebody who needs to go back to school. There are lots of economic reasons for it. But the result is that, if I could put this in its broadest way, that as people's experience deepens, it loses economic value.
Now, you then turn, and this is I think this is something I haven't encountered in your writing before. It seems to be an addition to your previous work in Respect and the Corrosion of Character. You turn to the area of consumption, and you want to show that the ways in which we go about choosing goods, the ways in which goods differentiate between themselves, have all sorts of analogies with the ways in which we go about selecting politicians and discriminating between their policies. Could I just... There's your prompt.
Very good. Well, that's a small question, so let me duck it by going back a stage, one step, to what that small question is framed by. In this new book on what I have tried to look at is the question of what sort of abilities suit people for this world. And I'd asked about... what do we mean by talent? How is somebody talented to navigate in this world? And I think the big shift there is a shift from ideas of craftsmanship about doing a job well and doing it for its own sake to a kind of different notion of talent, one which is focused not on what you already know how to do, but what you might do. That is
potential.
And most of our thinking about the kinds of ability that people have is to try and suspect who might be able to do something rather than to reward somebody from saying, well, he already knows how to do it. Let's put Jane or John Doe into that job. There's a good side of that because, you know, if people have untapped abilities, the organization wants to get it. The bad side of it is that this sense of craftsmanship is diminished. Of really knowing that if you master something, you really get involved in it, that you live in a world where you're going to get rewards for that. Now, I say this is all deep background. to understanding that some of the ways in which we deal with human talent, we're also beginning to deal with goods, the world of consumption. I don't know if you've ever thought to yourself why anybody would buy a Porsche Carrera, which is capable, I think, of 200 miles an hour, to drive 20 miles an hour or less in London traffic. Or why there are hundreds of thousands of these off-road SUV vehicles, which are sheltering not, you know, bags of sand, but groceries.
The Chelsea tractor.
Part of what that's about is the consumption of potential. You know, you could drive from Chelsea to the desert, right? Or if only there were no other people on the road, down the Euston Road, you could go 200 miles an hour.
I've got to pop your iPod example in here, because your iPod one, which is lovely there, which I think that because you've actually got some evidence there about an iPod, which, what, 10,000?
I actually owe this to my student, Michael Bull, who has studied iPods. This is what sociologists do for a life. Look, the iPod can hold up to 10,000 songs, the big iPod. But the human memory can really, most human beings can remember at most 20 or 30 songs. So what do? You're loading this thing up with more and more stuff, potentially, which you actually can't use. But it's enormously attractive to people because it could potentially hold so much. The same thing is true with computers. Most people use very few of the programs or the capabilities of the computers, but they want more and more power. So we're buying things not for what they practically do, but for what they might do. And that's one big cultural shift in consumption. The other part of consumption that has interested me is just the other side of that, which is that in global economy, we're seeing increasingly a peculiar kind of standardization. That is, cars are made on a kind of basic platform. And then they're transformed by what manufacturers call gold plating, which is to take on this sort of basic thing that you get, just minute differences, and inflate these to being enormously important symbolically. Now, those are two really striking phenomena. On the one hand, utility is no longer something that is really attractive to people in terms of consumption. And on the other hand, the things that they're consuming are themselves more divided between what their stuff really is, what Harvey Mallet calls their stuff, and how they appear. So the appearance is very different from the kind of common platform. What I've tried to do at the end of my book is to understand where that kind of culture of consumption influences politics.
So you've got to apply the notions of potency, potential, and goal plating to politics.
We do. And fortunately for sociologists, but maybe not so fortunately for the public, we are seeing this week in British politics. Essentially, the differences between Cameron and Blair are a matter of gold plating. If you didn't have the names on their speeches to tell me who's who.
So the basic platform underneath is the same. They're coming out of the same factory.
The Volkswagen platform is the same. Yeah. It's the same factory. The gold plating is to give it a kind of different cast so that it looks more important as a difference than it is. Equally with politics. That's the obvious side of it, and I think, you know, it's not the end of ideology. It's a different kind of thing. You have a common ideology and just try and inflate and recast its difference. But equally, the other side of this consumption of potential takes us back to where we started in this discussion about how organizational life works, which is that when you're constantly re-engineering a policy, when you don't let things bed in, when it doesn't become experience, but something that's a plan on a piece of paper, what you are doing is saying that the value lies in its potential for change, not in its realization. And what I'd say about this is that politicians are losing, what I have said about this in the book, is a sense of the craftsmanship of policy. That is, learning how to actually get from a plan, from a brand, to a practice. It's very striking to me in the education debates we're having this month in Britain that are based on a document which is very poorly crafted. It's mostly in bureaucratic speak. It's open to a lot of misinterpretation because nobody has really taken the care who drafted that document to craft it in a good way where it can be a subject for debate. There is, in my devil's view of all government, a hidden utility in that, which is if people don't understand what you're talking about, then when you discuss with them, you explain what the document means. So you take a kind of privilege over them. Oh, you haven't gotten it. If you know, I'm the expert. I really understand it. Now, that's a kind of condescension that's built into the culture of a lot of the new capitalism. That inner circle sort of gets it in the way in which the people ranged around this periphery don't. And you're seeing it, and we're seeing it in the States, too, in a different way, but you're seeing it in Britain laid out in these kinds of policy exercises. Inscrutable, with no attention to the craft of communication. That's empowering to people in the center.
Time means I've got to draw a line under this now. It means to say that I can't take you through to your final part of your book, which deals with where people might find a cultural anchor in this amorphous world that you have been describing, or in this uncaged capitalism, or within this new forms of consumption, this world. But let me just recommend the book. No one could possibly accuse you of obfuscation or obscurantism. It's called The Culture of the New Capitalism, and its author is Richard Sennett, and I thank you very much for talking to me about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'd love to hear your opinions on any aspect of that interview, but in particular, I suppose, on what might be called the crux of Stennett's analysis, the ways in which contemporary modes of working affect our character, if you like, our take on the world. Here are our addresses, Thinking Aloud, BBC Radio 4, Broadcasting House, London W181AA, and thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. And of course, if you do want to refresh your memory, you can always hear the programme again, and indeed, sign up to my inordinately successful newsletter, which this week deals with the nature of contemporary work, by going to our website. And you'll find that by going to bbc.co.uk/radio4. And I can only dare to hope that the letters and emails which relate to that interview with Stennett will be the same high quality as this week's correspondence. It really was a delight to read. Here, for example, is Paul Sorrell on the question of incentives as a way of curbing antisocial or non-compliant behaviour. My interest in incentives and rewards has come through my research into systems thinking, Paul writes. Cohen's excellent book, Punished by Rewards, shows that incentives can be effective in attaining compliance in the short term, but counterproductive in the longer run, and in fact can do lasting harm. There are numerous examples where rewards end up destroying people's intrinsic motivation. What lasting damage was being done to the tenants that previously paid their rent on time but were now being rewarded with £1 a week? Well, I'd suggest that if the incentive was withdrawn in the future, fewer tenants would be likely to pay on time. And here's Tim Tempest on the same theme. Laurie, I was surprised there was no comparison to the incentive schemes offered to CEOs and senior managers in both the public and private sectors. I see no difference, except in scale, between offering a manager an incentive, whether cash, stock options, travel, performance pay, offering all that to do the job for which he's been hired, and the rewards offered to tenants for certain types of behaviour. Is it patronising to offer a CEO several million in cash, stock options, etc., for performing his job in a satisfactory manner? If not, then why would offering incentives to tenants for satisfactory performance of their responsibilities as a resident in a neighbourhood? Or is this another case of the poor won't work or behave properly if they have any rewards, and the rich won't work or behave properly unless they get all the rewards? My thanks also on this topic to Peter Taylor Gooby of the University of Kent. Yes, Peter, please send me the paper that you describe. And to Robert Gore for a very relevant account of incentive schemes on German housing estates. No time to go into that. And to Barry Singleton for some telling remarks on the dangers of blaming parents for all social ills. Rather fewer thanks, though, to John Williams for this correction. I distinctly heard Laurie say in today's programme, scrounging off the welfare stoat. Weasel words, Laurie. And a big bucket of apologies to the 19 listeners who wrote in to correct my theology. You see, I said last week, just as an analogy, that no one would think of leaving Matthew or Mark off the list of Jesus' disciples. I had no idea we had such a religiously sophisticated audience. I mean, even Roger Bolton might have turned in his early Sunday morning slot at such a fusillade of corrections from biblical students like Paul Priest, Julian Gare, Stephen Leake, and the Reverend R. Toofer, who, with commendable Christian charity, I assume all reverends are Christians, he lets me off the hook this way. Laurie, in your latest edition, you say that no one would think of leaving Matthew or Mark off the list of Jesus' disciples. Actually, Mark wasn't one of the 12 disciples, and Luke leaves Matthew off the list. But you have a technical defence, since you said disciplines, not apostles. Technical, because the 12 are often referred to in everyday speech as the 12 disciples, not as the 12 apostles, and Mark, one of the four evangelists, was definitely a disciple, though not one of the 12. I knew all that already. Just time for a teaser. What's the one word in the name of the band which recorded this number back in 1923, which has been so exercising one of this country's leading anthropologists? Answer next week. Oh, play that thing.
You don't think he's actually dancing, do you? Thinking Aloud was presented by Laurie Taylor and produced by Andrew Littlejohn. Now, what's best for the treatment of heart failure, rest or exercise? Find out in a moment after a look ahead with Eddie Mayer now, 2 p.m. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, there's a big shake-up ahead for the Child Support Agency. Details still coming in. We'll have more at 5. Also, is the reality of identity fraud A good enough reason to bring in identity cards, Tony Blair told MPs today that it is. What's the best way of paying for the European Union? The Austrian presidency has suggested a sort of Europe tax. We'll debate the pros and cons.